It has been a real pleasure over the years. I came on the board of trustees in 1990, and there were several people on the board of trustees that I really connected with. And the woman that is our speaker tonight, I connected with quite a bit, and I really liked what she had to say, and she was sort of a mentor to me on the board. And it was really a pleasure to get to know her. And I saw her while she was on the board go through a lot of heartache and a lot of pain and a lot of growth. And I have observed that into her for many, many years. It is my real pleasure to introduce my friend Lee R. from Massachusetts as our speaker for the night. Lee, it's all yours.
Thank you, Joe. Joe, can you give me a 10-minute warning?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Happy to.
Every time I speak, I never prepare much in the way of notes. I always ask God to let me be a vehicle for him, for some message that needs to be said. And I also ask that I take my ego out of anything that I do. And I hopefully I can say something that people can identify with. So some of the stats I'll start off with. I came into the program in 1984. So I've been in 38 years. I was 37 when I came in. That first year, after about 2 months, I got abstinent, and I was abstaining for 13 years, never broke my abstinence. And then I relapsed, and I chased recovery again, never left the rooms, and I'm going to talk a little bit on that. Then currently, as of March 1st, I have 6 years again, back-to-back abstinence. Thank you. So a little bit of what I was like before. Like many OAs, I grew up in a dysfunctional home. Although at the time, I didn't realize how dysfunctional it was. So, you know, later looking back, my father was an alcoholic. We never used that word. He did not see himself as an alcoholic because he would wait until 4 o'clock in the afternoon to have his first drink. If he was drinking beer, we were in good shape because he was the funny drunk and he would just fall asleep in his room or in his bed. If he was hitting the hot stuff, he was the scary dad. And I went into hiding up in my room and tried to avoid him at all costs. My mother's coping mechanism, I think, you know, she was one of us. I'm pretty sure she was. When she got married, she weighed 98 pounds, and I have a wedding picture. And 1 year later, she was up to 200 pounds. I have a brother. Well, I have a brother. He's since passed, who is 9 years older than me. And I have a sister who is 8 years younger than me. So I never really felt close with my siblings. It was such an age difference. You know, I think back to when I was a younger kid, I can remember so much fear at night because my parents would like go to the local city and they'd stop at some bar that was like, if you can call it family oriented, it was. They had like shuffleboard and there were foods my mother could get her fixed. But driving back as a little kid, I can remember being so scared in the back seat because a few times the car did go off the road a little. And, you know, to the best of my ability, I remember trying to pray. My family were French Canadian. So for the first 12 years of my life, the church that we went to, up until a certain point, the mass was all in Latin, and when the priest gave the homily, that was all in French. And so I really did not get a heck of a lot out of attending church with my parents. But I can remember even then, like knowing there was something that was hopefully going to take care of me. So, you know, I can't say... there was never a lot of love shown in my household. And I really think part of it was the culture in that generation, but my parents never even expressed a lot of love to each other. My father would get mushy with my mother when he was drinking, and my mother would push him away. I can remember 3 times in my life my father saying that he loved me. I cannot remember, honestly, my mother until just before she passed saying that she loved me. But it's funny, the difference though, I knew my father loved me because of the actions that he did. The daytime dad would take me places. We'd go to an amusement park and he would ride the roller coaster with me, even though he knew he was going to throw up after, you know, just to please me. So I think back, you know, even with all the, you know, the chaos, my brother was a juvenile delinquent. We always had cops showing up. You know, and I think back too of like, they know he's a juvenile delinquent. They know he's a kid apt to get into trouble. Why would you buy a kid a BB gun for their birthday? And he immediately shot out the picture window of the house across the street, you know, stuff like that. But it was crazy, but there was a lot of good stuff too. We had a summer cottage. I ran with all the kids. So it's a mixed bag, but it's like a lot of people had a lot of stuff when they came into program. I do want to say that, from the time I was like in grammar school, I always felt like I was a big kid. And I was looking for my little OA, you know, pictures that I used to use at meetings. When I look back, I was not a fat kid. I had maybe an extra, maybe like 5-10 pounds on me, but they were all muscle. As I get older, I biked like, I can't tell you how many miles a day on a weekend I would bike. I played baseball with the boys in the field. I played touch football with the boys in the field. I was very muscular and I was very active. And so I was a tomboy. So, but in my mind, all I thought of was a fat person. And I also grew up feeling like I just didn't belong. I didn't fit in any place. When I was in junior high, they did testing of everyone. And I tested out that the teachers felt that I should be in my 7th and 8th grade an advanced curriculum that they had set up. And I tried and I told my parents, no, you can't do that to me. All the brains are in that. They don't even have to study for the, you know, tests. But I still had to fit in. And a lot of my friends weren't in these classes. And as we got into high school, I had courses that were college-bound courses. And then I had some courses that were like secretarial type stuff. And so I had friends in both the groups, but neither groups really hung out with each other. There was definitely divisions. And I just didn't feel like I really fit in any place. I can remember, my father felt that education after high school for a female was a complete waste of money because, you know, a girl is just going to get married and that's the end of the use of the education. And so my father, and also he felt that girls that went off to like schools, colleges that they had dorms, were just little tramps. And he wasn't going to spend his money to have me become a little tramp. So, I had no intentions of going to college. And luckily I was taking a bookkeeping course in high school. And my teacher took me aside and she put the idea in my head about being an accounting major, that you can do a career in this vein. And I got good grades in it. And so I went back to my father and I pleaded and I cried. And finally he said, okay, if you can find a school that you can commute to, I'll let you go to school. And, back then I didn't know I had a God working in my life. It's only now I can look back at so many things and I see how my higher power, my God, was always working in my life, because I sent out one application for college. That's all I could find where I could go. And I was accepted. And you know what? The 4 years of college, you know how people, everyone, male and female, often put on, I forget how many pounds, they say the freshman 20, I think it is, or whatever. I never put on any weight in college because I was so happy. I was finally in my element. I will tell you, before I went, that summer before I went to college, but again, in my mind, I'm fat, fat, fat. I've got to lose weight so I can be thin in college. I went on this like diet of lettuce and water, hardly eating anything. And my parents didn't notice it until 3 Sundays in a row I passed out in church in the pew. And then my mother finally said, I got to bring you to the doctor. Something's wrong with you. Well, I was so anemic. And I, you know, and so they put me on, you know, liver pills and whatever. But the story still is that I did lose quite a bit of weight. And I went into my freshman year, you know, very slender. And I stayed that way all through college. So they were happy years. So I have to also tell you that I am a one of my character defects, but I've learned to do a turnaround and make it a positive thing. I am a control freak. And so in college, I had written, you know, a 5-year plan for my life after I got out. And I had a 10-year plan for my life after I got out. And my 5-year plan, towards the end of it, I would meet someone and start, you know, seriously dating someone. And somewhere in the 10 years, I would get married. I don't know if I ever planned in children in that. Well, I met this guy. Our first date was New Year's Eve. It was a bunch of my college male friends, because accounting majors were pretty much all men. And I, you know, I got along with them like brothers, and that's how they looked towards me. And so I had this date with this guy, and I thought he was like, I worked at a kind of a sleazy, it was called a doghouse restaurant on a bridge in Fairhaven, Mass. And I would work there after, I had night shifts, so I worked there after school. And I met this guy, and he had a good sense of humor. He had a great smile. And we started talking. Long story short, I was going to go on a date with him New Year's Eve, and I was going to a VFW where all my friends were going to be. And I had it lined up with these guys that if this guy got out of line with me, they were going to beat the shit out of him. Well, he never got out of line. We hit it off. Long story short, we got married in September of that year, which was not in the plan, but I had planned to room with my best nursing school buddy in Boston, and she broke the plans by getting engaged first. So I'm like, ah, what the hell, might as well, I can't afford a place on my own, does he, you know? But again, like God put like the perfect guy in my life. My husband truly was my soulmate. My husband, more than soulmate, my husband was my best friend. We just had so much fun together. We just enjoyed each other's company. So, okay, so I accepted that little glitch in my plan. Then 3 months after I was married, I got pregnant. Well, this is when the God of my understanding at the time, I got so angry at, because I really thought that God is playing a dirty trick on me. You know, here I did all this to have a career, and now I'm pregnant, and this is not in my plan. And, you know, I had my daughter, who's the joy of my life, and I live with my daughter, and my grandson, except he's in the Navy now. But I got angry at God, and I'm angry at God. I'm angry because I can't control my life. It's not going the way I want. And what do? This is when I really turned to food, full-heartedly. This is when the binging took place. You know, initially people were saying, well, you're eating for two, it's okay. I put on 40 pounds with that baby. And she was 7 pounds, 8 ounces. I thought at least I should be able to say I would lose 7 pounds, 8 ounces. I didn't even lose that. When I left the hospital, I think I had dropped like 2 pounds, you know, probably because of fluids and stuff. But I was angry at that. I had so much anger. And so I would, you know, binge eat. And then you all know, you do the yo-yo dieting, you know, and I tell my husband, well, I'm on a diet, so don't tempt me with, you know, all this crap in the house. We can't have this. And then the next thing, he sees me breaking the diet, you know, and that went on for quite a few years. It went on to the point that I, about 3 days before my first OA meeting in 1984, I had been doing like one of the commercial weight plans with a friend. And we would, you know, go to this place, sign up, weigh in. The first couple of weeks, we'd do really great. We would go for an ice cream after, you know, just to reward ourselves. And then the next 2-3 weeks, we're doing horrible. And we'd go for an ice cream to console ourselves. And then we'd quit. And then we'd find a new location that we could sign up where they didn't know us. So we had done this a number of times. So it was about 3 days before my first OA meeting. And I hated myself. I hated the fact I could control things. I could control my finances. I could manage people. I had a great paying job. You know, I had a good daughter. She was a great kid. But I could not control the eating. And I saw nothing but hatred for myself. When I would look in the mirror, I would call myself names that I would never call another person. And finally, I couldn't take it anymore. And I finally decided that I wanted to kill myself because I just hated myself so much. And I couldn't stop eating. And so I was going to get in the car. I knew a road that had a bend in it, had a good long straightaway, then a bend, and there was a tree right at the bend. And that's how I was going to do it. And I got in the car and I started speeding up. And all of a sudden, a voice, and I know again, it was my higher power watching out for me, a voice said, but if you don't do this job right, you could end up a vegetable. And your wonderful, loving husband is going to be taking care of that vegetable for the rest of his life. And I wouldn't do that to him. So I slowed down, and it was either 1 or 2 days after my commercial weight loss buddy said, hey, I'm going to this place. You don't even have to pay. They pass around a basket and people lose weight. And they're all like happy and they're really nice. Do you want to go? And I'm like, yeah, of course I want to go. And so we went the first meeting. I honestly didn't believe a lot of the people when, you know, they were talking about how much they had lost. I'm like, yeah, right. But they had a guy qualifying who had lost, it was over 300 pounds. And he had lost it. He had maintained that loss for 6 years. And at first I didn't believe it, you know, until he had pictures that he passed. But then am I sure this is really the same guy? But then he had his old pants and he got into one leg of those pants. And I knew like this was for true. You know, this guy was not making this up. So that caught my attention. And, you know, I kind of like a lot of talk about God, you know, and back then, like they always closed the meetings with the Our Father. And so, you know, is this a cult of some type? But I will tell you, when we held hands, and my husband used to call it the chanting, because we used to have intergroup meetings at my house, and we'd say the serenity prayer at the end, you know, and then we'd like hold hands and go and keep coming back. You know, it works if you work it. Well, when I held hands, I felt something I had never felt in my life. And what I felt was, I belong. I belong to this group. I am truly one of these people. And I never forgot that feeling. And so I want to go ahead, jump ahead to my third-year program. The first 2 years, all I cared about was weight loss. Let me just take a sip. I lost, I think it was like 86 pounds in 10 months. And I didn't do it a healthy way, and I wouldn't suggest anyone to do it the way I did. I really controlled my weight, my food intake, to not more than between 800 to 900 calories a day, which is not good. But I lost the weight. And luckily, my first sponsor was someone that gave me the love for service. And I'll get more into that after. But she, you know, she was the head of our intergroup. She would go like drive great distance to qualify at a meeting, and she would bring me along with her. And so, you know, I saw that. And but I never really got into the big book or the steps. I used the big book that summer. I had bought it to keep a window open that kept slipping down. That's the extent of my use of the big book. And it wasn't until actually my third sponsor in my third year, I had to get a new sponsor. And this woman came in just so serene and knowledgeable. But, you know, she would say her shares were just like, they made so much sense. And I wanted what she had. So I asked her if she would sponsor me. And she said yes. And what I didn't realize was, when she sponsored you, it wasn't only about the food and committing your food plan daily. It was taking you through the steps. And back then, we didn't have the OA 12 and 12. She actually was also an AA member. And so she was well-versed in the steps using the big book and the AA 12 and 12. And so, you know, she would give me reading and writing assignments. And then I would go to her house every Saturday, and we would talk about whatever step I was on. And, you know, I think of the service that woman did, the time that she spent with me. But, you know, that was really the true beginning of my recovery in this program, was going through the steps with her. And, you know, when I did the second step, I had trouble still with God, as I understood God. And she would say, well, let it stand for good orderly direction or power of the group. And that was okay. But then when I got to the third step, I wanted something more. And that's, you know, when she said, okay, well, fire the God of your understanding, write a job description. And she gave me pen and paper, and I wrote it down, what I wanted my higher power to be: always loving, never leaving me, always supporting, always having my back, sense of humor. I forgot to put works quickly, so I have to accept that God works on his own timetable. But we did that. And then we set it on fire, and the smoke going up was it being posted. And she says, and now you have the new God of your understanding. This is your higher power. And I can remember looking at her, and I probably had a smirk on my face or something. And she goes, I know you really don't buy into this yet. She goes, but believe that I believe. And until you believe, you act as if. And that's when she introduced the act as if to me. And so, you know, when things would happen, I'd get a little scared. I started acting as if I have this God in my life. and I would start talking to God. And I can remember, you know, sometimes spiritual awakening can be a very slow process for some people, but I had something happen that was my spiritual awakening, and I never ever questioned that I had a God in my life. Gotten a call. My husband and I had gotten a call early in the morning, like 3 a.m., to tell us that my husband's 19-year-old niece had hung herself in her sister's basement. And all the family, they were like an hour from us. So we went racing down there to get together with the family. And we talked about the fact that this young girl that took her life, her middle sister lived alone on the Cape and was only 1 year sobriety in AA. And, you know, we didn't want to just call and tell her. We wanted in person. The phone rang. Some neighbor had heard on the police scanner what happened, took it on themselves to call her. And she was hysterically crying on the phone. And so, you know, I said, okay, I'm going to go in the car with my younger nephew. Tell her we'll be there as soon as we can. So I'm racing to the Cape. I'm in Falmouth. It's now like, you know, 4:30 in the morning, still dark out. There's no street lights at all. I've never been to her house. I just have an address. And I'm up and down. I'm on the right road, but I can't even see signs of, you know, numbers of houses or anything. And I'm starting to feel panic. And I can remember saying to my nephew, we got to find the police station so they can help us. And I'm going to turn around. And as I was getting ready to turn around in this a dirt road, a little driveway, I remember kind of throwing my eyes up to the heavens and saying, God, I have been trying so long to really believe you are there for me. I need some kind of a sign from you because I am really scared. I need your help. And I turned into that driveway and there was a whale on a post and it was her address. It was her house. And, you know, some may say coincidence, but it was for me a God happening. I never ever questioned God in my life again. And I want to, where am I on time, Joe?
You have about 20 minutes.
Okay, great. I want to get back to the steps a little bit more because going through, you know, the step process, especially looking at, you know, resentments, I couldn't believe all the resentments I held. I held a resentment to this when I was a 6-year-old down at our summer cottage. This 80-year-old woman would call me, not Leona, she'd say Leonora. And I'd say, no, Mrs. Whitaker, my name is Leona. And she said, next time, okay, Leonora. I had a resentment that I held for all those years towards that lady because of that. And I'm like, holy cow, you know, there was so much stuff that came out. And as my sponsor said, and more shall be revealed. Which is true, because I've gone through the steps like 3 or 4 times. I've used the, first was using the format and book. I've used the OA 12 and 12, which I got different things came out of that. So I can't say enough, you know, just go through the steps. It doesn't matter what format. And if you use one, try a different one next time. But anyways, making amends too. Was such an uplifting thing for me. I can remember writing to my brother this letter. There had been a big, I won't go into it, it's too long a story, but he had gotten nasty, I had gotten nasty on the phone. It had to do with my mother. And I wrote a letter for my father of what I said that I was sorry and hope, you know, that we could have a better relationship. And I don't remember what else. He never, ever responded. And I know, you know, when my mom died, I could tell he was so uncomfortable in my presence. And I was not the least bit uncomfortable because I had cleared my side of the street. And it's just like some other, you know, amends that I made. I just felt such a relief after. My sister was funny. She not only agreed with everything that I said I was sorry for, she added some other things that I forgot to mention, but that's okay. You know, and there was there's still two people that I have an amends to make to. I don't have no idea where in the world they are. But if God wants me to make an amends to them, I'm going to hopefully tell this story real quick. He will put them in my path, in my life. There was I had a friend who was my age in grammar school. She was a tomboy too. And between her house and my house was another little girl who was not a tomboy. She had the curly, you know, curls in her hair. Half the time was in little dresses. You know, we were in jeans, and my friend Sandy and I would have a contest to see how long we could get away with wearing the jeans before our mothers made us wash them. Talk about sick. But anyway, so we didn't like Carolyn because she wasn't like us. She wasn't a tomboy. And her mom and my mom and Sandy's mom one day said, you got to play with Carolyn. She's right close. She has no friends. You play with her. So we're in the backyard. And she had a barn because she had horses. And Carolyn says, I dare you to climb on top of the barn and jump off into the hay down below. And Sandy goes, okay, we'll do it, but you got to do it too. So the three of us are up there. Sandy jumps first. She was 2 years younger than me, but she was a daredevil. And she actually got me in more trouble than I ever thought of getting in myself. Then I jumped, and I didn't like heights all that much, but I jumped. And Carolyn's up on top, and we're saying, it's your turn, it's your turn. And she starts crying, no, no, I can't do it. And Sandy and I said, we did it. You bet us, yes, you're going to do it. And we climbed back up, and we pushed her off the barn. She came down, she broke her arm. We found out after, but she was hurting her arm. And we had to jump down after her. And she's running towards her house. And we said, and if you tell your mother we pushed you, we're going to wait for you and we're going to break the other arm. I was not a perfect child, let me tell you. But so this Carolyn was on my list for years, you know, but there were other things too. And so one night, a mutual friend, her mother died. I was at the wake and I found out that this Sandy owned a restaurant at the New Bedford Airport. And so I figured I'd stop in to say hi. I hadn't seen her for years. And so I'm sitting at the bar where she was tending and we were talking about this Carolyn. And I said, oh my God, I have such apology to make to her. We were just so horrible to her. I can't believe how horrible we were. And the door to the restaurant had one of these squeaky doors. So when it squeaked, like you couldn't help but kind of like turn to look who's coming through. It was Carolyn Booth. She had taken a flight from Hyannis into New Bedford. And she saw us and came right away walking up and she big smiles and happy to see us, you know. And I couldn't believe it, but I knew this is probably the only chance I'm going to have to make my amends. And so I said, Carolyn, I am so sorry for the horrible kid that I was to you when you were younger. And she looked at me and she goes, I don't remember you being horrible. And I couldn't believe it. She didn't remember, but I certainly did. And it felt so good to be able to say, I am so sorry, you know, that I treated you that way. There's still a couple of people, but like I said, if God wants me to make an amends to them, they will be in my death. You know, I'll have the opportunity. So I think one of the best amends is living amends. And, you know, I made amends to my mother and father for different things, but I honestly never felt for most of my adult life love towards my mother. My father I did, but not my mother. And after my father died, they were in Florida. After my father died, you know, my mother was on her own, and I would go down with my husband two or three times a year to just like paint, clean windows, whatever. But this one trip, my husband couldn't make it, so I was going on my own. And I was saying to my sponsor at the time, I said, I just hate doing this so much. And she goes, why? And I said, I feel such an emptiness when I'm with my mother. I don't even know what to say to her. I feel like I'm, you know, talking with a stranger. And she goes, well, you know, you've got to make an effort to take time to do something you both can enjoy. So it's not just, you know, a chore on your part. So I thought, you know, she's right. So my mother used to love long drives along the ocean, and she didn't drive anymore. And so one day I made plans. We weren't, you know, that's all we were going to do was take a long drive. And I've got to back up a minute and tell you that when I was about 6 years old, my mother was pregnant, and she had gone off for the day with my father, and I wanted to surprise her. And so I had washed the floor the way I always saw her do it, with the bucket and the rags and the scrub brush. And then you wipe it with rags and let it dry, and then you wax it and kind of, you know, it was, you didn't buff it, but you wax it. And my mother came home, and I said, look, Mom. And she goes, oh, nice job. And next thing I know, she's changing her clothes and she's getting down on the floor with the bucket and the mop and redoing the whole floor. And I can remember running into my room and crying. So anyways, I'm driving along this beautiful coast in Florida, and my mother and I are talking, and I didn't know much about my grandmother on my mother's side. My mother was saying how she was a midwife and had actually brought a lot of babies into the world, including my brother. And then my mother said, yeah, and as a matter of fact, she saved Lucille. And I said, what do you mean? What did she do? And my mother said, well, I had gone to the doctor, and he had said that the baby was going to be a breech birth. The umbilical cord was, you know, wrapped around the neck the wrong way. And I went to my mother, my grandmother, and started crying and telling her what, you know, the doctor had said. And she said, my grandmother told her to go straight home, change your clothes, get down on the floor and wash the floor, because that movement would make the baby move around or turn around. Well, I'll tell you, I almost went off the road when I heard that, because all the years I thought, my mother had done that because I didn't do the job right. My mother had done that because she was trying to save her baby. And I felt such a closeness after that, you know, and because I actually had a conversation with my mother. I was treating her like I would another OA person, like an OA person, really listen, not just, you know, letting them talk and be thinking, oh, what do I need to do when I get home or that type thing. I would not have that kind of a blessing if it wasn't for this program. So I want to get into service. As I said, my first sponsor was so much in service. I got into service very early. I was chair of my intergroup before I even had a year. And that's because that first sponsor left program, and we had a contract with someone coming in to speak. But I got involved with Region, and I loved all the conventions that Region put on. You know, I'm a real convention junkie, and I just loved that part of it. And I loved the first time that I ever went out to the World Service Business Conference, the first time that we did a standing vote, I can remember tears coming down my face because it just like moved me so much to know that I was helping to make, you know, a decision on the matters that affect OA as a whole. You know, it was just unbelievable to think that I was a part of that process. And then our region, our trustee at the time, her name was Barr, was going to be stepping down. And our region at the time used to have a policy. They didn't just send one, one person running for trustee. They would send you three candidates. So that conference would always have a choice. That's how they viewed it. And so myself and another woman and a guy went to conference, and I was not elected. My best friend Pat S. was, and I was fine with that because I was scared out of my pants anyways. You know, the only reason that I did it was because this person took me aside and said, I would like you to consider doing this. I know you can do it. And I said, I don't know if I can do it. You know, I don't know. And she said, the best service you can do is service that gets you out of your comfort zone. And the worst thing you can do, you can try something. If you can't do it, you can ask for help. And if it's really not good, then you can just step down. Thank you. And so they had a GST had resigned. And so they had an opening. And I got a call that summer asking if I would consider applying. And I did. And I got appointed. And then I had to run for my own spot, which I did. And then I had to run again. I don't know. I seemed like I was always running for that position. But I got to meet so many wonderful people along the way. excuse me. Made such many, you know, so many good friends. One of the things nearing the end of my term, my last year, I was a treasurer two years for OA, and I actually had signed the loan for our office when we got the office. I'm like, they're not going to come after me, really, are they? But that last year, the different trustees kept saying, well, we'd like to put you up to be chairman of the board. And, you know, that was the first time in my life that I felt like such a gut feeling, like, no, this is one service. No, don't do this. Don't do this. and it wasn't just a fear thing. It was something different. And I can remember Joe coming and he said, I'm thinking of running. And I heard you're not interested in the chair. And I said, honest to God, Joe, no, go for it. Well, I think it was God giving me, you know, I've learned to my gut feelings. I trust him now. And I think it was God giving me this gut feeling, because that summer, my husband started having real issues with panic attacks and depression. And he started going on like all these different meds. And long story short, that December 13th, my husband hung himself just like his niece had done. And I thought we were getting to the other end of the tunnel, because, you know, we had walked and he had laughed. It was the first time I had heard him laugh, but I guess I've read that when they've made up their minds, there's like a light, you know, they feel light, whatever. But why I'm sharing this is I cannot tell you how much the support of the fellowship meant to me. When I found my husband, the first call was to my neighbor up the street, his best friend. second call was to the police, and the third call was to my sponsor, who lived an hour away and was going to, you know, just jump in the car. And I said, no, I just need you to know what's going on and pray for me. But I mean, I got support from all of the board and, you know, people I had met. I had done retreats, you know, overseas in Australia, New Zealand. I got letters of support. Fellowship is such a beautiful thing that we have. And it got me through so much. And the following month, my husband's 27-year-old nephew, he was a year older than my daughter. So the two kids, we would take them on trips together, vacationing. He got killed in a freak accident. And we went through all the mourning, you know, seeing again. And I can remember I was actually coming back from I was at a board meeting and had just finished when I got the telephone call about the death. And I raced, as soon as I got from the airport, I raced directly to Fairhaven, where my sister-in-law. Is that time?
No, you're fine.
Oh, okay. Where my sister-in-law was. And I can remember flying into the room and seeing me throwing up her hands and saying, Lee, why is God doing this to us? And I, you know, I hugged her and I could, you know, with every ounce of my being, I said, He is not doing this to us. Things happen, Gloria, but if ever a time you need to keep Him close to you, it's now. God is going to help us get through this. God will help us get through anything. We just have to reach out to Him and ask for the help. And I was so glad that, you know, I could be of support to her through her pain. Thank you. And I just want to say one more thing about service. I mentioned about sometimes service is going out of your comfort zone. When I was, I know I was still on the board, I think, maybe not. But there was a gal from Oklahoma, or a trustee, and she's not on our listing, Joe. I was looking for it to send her a little note. But anyways, Walt Sue called me one weekend and she said, Lee, have you ever led a retreat? And I said, no, I've been to a number of them, but I've never led one. She goes, well, we'd like to have you lead a retreat for us. And I went, are you sure? And she goes, yeah, we'll pay for your ticket. So I tried to find the cheapest ticket I could, and it was like $500. And she says, you know, I called her back. No, that's fine. We want you. So I spent quite a bit of time going through notes of different retreats, stuff that I liked the retreat leader did. I didn't like the retreats that they just talked and talked and talked, and there was no interaction, you know, with the people, exercises, you know, writing, whatever. So I put together this plan for the weekend. 2 days before I'm supposed to fly out, I'm as sick as a dog with this cold, and my throat was raspy. And I can remember saying, please, God, let me be able to do this retreat. These people paid for all this money for a flight. And so I went out, and you know, it was the greatest time. They were going to put me in my own separate little cabin. It was like out in the woods someplace. And I was going to have my own separate little cabin. I wouldn't be in the, like the big bunkhouse, you know. When I heard the wolves starting to howl at 4 o'clock at night, I said, is there room for me to be in that big house with everyone? Because I'm thinking like, if the wolves break in, at least the odds are in my favor, right? It's four of us. But the retreat went wonderful. It was like the last 20 minutes my voice gave. And, you know, I still have letters. I used to have people write love letters during the retreats to each other. And I still have kept some of those love letters. And I had done like a number of retreats after. But I, you know, if I hadn't gone out of my comfort zone, and again, someone saying, I think you can do this service, you know, why don't you try? And I guess I just want to end with that. There's such a need of service in our fellowship, especially, you know, as trustees, any level. If there's something, you know, you see someone and you think they could do it, but they're hesitant, you know, be a supporter, you know, get on their bandwagon, make them feel like, you know, they can do it, because probably they can. And I wouldn't have been where I was today if it wasn't for Angie and people like that. So I think I must be just about out of time. And I just want to say that I hope I touched on something that someone can use. I think I was like a little, I didn't really talk that much about the relapse. I'll just say I never left. I knew the program worked. I kept going to meetings. I kept asking God, and the miracle happened again. So, you know, and you don't have to relapse in this program. There's many relapse that I'm looking at that I know never did. And that's wonderful. Sometimes it happens. And if it does, don't feel shame. We have a disease. We have a bad disease. It doesn't make us bad people. And there's always room, you know, for us to grow. And that's it. Thank you.